Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Welcome to Valley Roundup during this summer's pledge drive. I'm Carolyn Sacharyason. Thank you for listening and your support. It's listeners like you who we rely on to produce shows like Valley Roundup. So please take a moment and make your financial contribution. No pledge is too small or large. We are here to take your donation. Please call 920-9000 or online at aspenpublicradio.org. And now, let's get on with the show. A Colorado Mountain College board member is taking heat from her colleagues for publicly expressing her opinions about the taxpayer-funded institution.
It's because it looks like the board is trying to be a private, closed body.
Have we reached our carrying capacity in the high country?
These guys don't need to be burying people's crap, and that's what they're forced to do. Last year alone, they buried 351 piles.
And a proposal to build a 68,000-square-foot hotel at the base of Aspen Mountain is causing angst among many, including avid skiers of the Lift 1A side.
They tell me how I can ski Norway, and I've been skiing it for 40 years of my life. I've skied it thousands of times. It makes me mad.
Meanwhile, the Basalt Town Council is entertaining the idea of asking voters to buy the Pan and Fork parcel. And the Aspen City Council this week couldn't come to a consensus on whether to build the new city hall.
Really, for the last maybe 4 months, they have been in, you know, reevaluating that decision. And it finally came to a head this week.
Joining me during this special Summer Pledge Drive edition is a combined 115 years of local knowledge among this panel of veteran journalists. Roger Morolt, columnist for the Aspen Times and Snowmass Sun, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Scott Condon, reporter for the Aspen Times, and Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent. Thank you for being on the phone in Glenwood.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so I really found your CMC story really interesting.
I think it is a fascinating situation. We wrote a news story and an editorial, and in the editorial we said that it seems that the CMC board, which looked at censure for a trustee who had written a couple of letters to the editor, it seems like that the CMC board really is fostering a closed culture and that it punishes dissent. If you are in the minority, you find yourself with an opponent who has served on the CMC Foundation board in the past, both Kathy Gowdy and Mary Ellen Denami, who Mary Ellen was the trustee who was the subject of potential censure, had opponents in their last election campaigns that they were able to defeat, but those folks had close ties to CMC. I think that this situation underscored to me what I knew already, that Western Colorado newspapers, news organizations, need to do a better job of following CMC.
Absolutely. It's an institution that does not get enough scrutiny.
It's growing. And, you know, I do want to say that I think CMC is a real leader and a real asset to Western Colorado. The editorial said that we weren't really talking about the merits of Mary Ellen Denami's letters to the editor, which opposed certain aspects of the budget, but that we're standing up for her right to tell her constituents why she's voting the way that she's voting, which was the purpose of her letters to the editor.
Right. So just as a setup, she was censored by other members of the board because she was writing letters to the editor regarding what her thoughts were and her feelings about the institution and the board, right?
She was not censured. The motion was brought before the board at a meeting, and it was clear that Patty Theobald, who's a trustee from Summit County, Glenn Davis, who's the board chair, were prepared to go forward and vote for it. In fact, an open records request that I filed turned up a statement that had been prepared for release to the media about the censure vote, but they pulled it back. They have a board retreat coming up at the end of August, and Glenn Davis, who is the board chair, insisted, he had to ask two or three times, but insisted that Mary Ellen pledge that she won't write any more letters to the editor before the board retreat. And then he told me whether the censure motion comes back up again, depends on how the conversation goes at the board retreat. So,
well, to me, it seems like they are acting like a private body.
And that's what Glenn said. He said that we're not like a city council or a county commission that passes ordinances that affect everybody within our jurisdiction. We are more like a nonprofit or a private enterprise board, fiduciary responsibility toward the institution that we support.
Taxpayer-based?
I disagree with that. The board is the public's representative in allocating $47 million a year that come out of our property taxes.
Absolutely. I thought Kathy Gatti's quote in your story was spot on. What did it say?
Said it was a sandbagging. I think it's really ironic. Patty Theobald said in her motion and said before the board that this was doing extreme harm to the college. And gosh, without the Board of Trustees considering censure, nobody would have paid attention to it.
Right.
So I think that, and the editorial said, if there's damage being done, it's because it looks like the board is trying to be a private, closed body.
As all forms of media, we ought to be taking a look at that more.
Yep. Join us at Aspen Public Radio.
Right. Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn.
That was Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent. Now I'm joined by Scott Condon, reporter for the Aspen Times, Roger Mrull, columnist for the Aspen Times and Sonoma Sun, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. So, Scott, you spent the day with a wilderness ranger on the four-pass loop.
Yeah, we went up with one of the veteran wilderness rangers. We took off from the Snowmass Lake trailhead outside of Snowmass Village, and we took off at noon on Friday and stayed with him until noon on Saturday.
And what'd you find?
You know, we found that it was no surprise that the trail was busy. This was a Friday that we were hiking up, and, you know, we ran into, I think, 14 groups with 42 people that had were either still at the lake or were hiking back from the lake. And that wasn't any real surprise, but I guess what the surprise was is the amount of human waste up there. The compliance with bear canisters was 50% or slightly better than that. That meaning that half the people had proper bear-proof containers for their food and their garbage. But the truly disturbing thing is that, you know, the White River National Forest, Aspen-Sopus District, is already short funds to have their Wilderness Ranger program properly staffed, and these guys don't need to be burying people's crap, and that's what they're forced to do. Last year alone, they buried 351 piles scattered throughout the Maroon Bell Snowmass Wilderness.
That is unbelievable to me.
That is unbelievable.
For these hardworking guys that are basically, you know, it's a public service type of job.
Yeah.
Right.
To be subjected to that.
What I find so curious is that the people who go and, you know, are backpacking or, you know, backcountry backpacking seem to be the kind of people that understand the leave no trace ethos and understand that you have to take everything out, including your waste.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think there are some very exemplary backpackers and people that do the right thing. But for whatever reason, I don't know how you can get inspired to put 30 to 40 pounds on your back, backpack up 8 miles, you know, getting to that lake, and then somehow feeling like it is okay to leave toilet paper and waste around. It's just mind-boggling.
I think if people looked around, they'd be disgusted by what they find, but I think there's a mentality like, well, it's just me this time. It won't be that big a deal. And it's sort of the same mentality when people let their dogs crap on Smuggler and just leave it. And, you know, it accumulates and it adds up and it's a big deal.
A few bad apples spoil the whole bunch.
You got to get people used to this idea of the whole portable toilet system and actually hauling it out.
Yeah.
That's a great point, Curtis. I mean, the WAG bags, that's one of the trailheads, along with Conundrum, where Forest Service provides what they call WAG bags, or these, you know, it's not just like your doggy do bag. It's actually much more secure than that. And, you know, you can carry your waste out, and if you do it right, you're not going to cause any problems with your pack or anything. So
right.
People just need to get over that and start doing it.
I think there's a big education thing that's going to have to happen, because as your story pointed out, it's a very popular spot. There's a lot of people up there. there's no other way. Otherwise, it's going to become a, you know, even worse of a problem than we're seeing today.
I think it highlights that there will be a permit system, and I think there ought to be at this point. There's too many people. I'm not inspired, and I haven't been inspired to go up to Conundrum or Four Pass Loop or even Electric Pass or anything, because you just told me there's 42 people up there. I don't want to see 42 people.
Well, think about American Lake and Cathedral Lake and the day hikes. They're so crowded, you can't believe it. I think we've got to start talking about this along with development in the town. It's, you know, we talk about development, we talk about infrastructure, roads, employee housing, sewer, water, sanitation. But never in the discussion is the impact that growth and development has on the surrounding wilderness.
So when they add that extra nonstop flight from Houston, you don't think about the extra pile of poop up at
or another hotel in town. That's 60 opportunities for more poop out in the wilderness. So it's so that's a way to regulate it. It's just by thinking about what we're doing here in town too.
Yeah, I mean the basic issue, I believe, is have we reached our carrying capacity?
Yeah,
I think out in the wilderness we have. Don't you feel? Scott, I mean, how did it feel up there? Did it feel crowded?
It was crowded, you know, and we were kind of the point that I probably didn't stress enough in the article was when Jeremy Wallace, the Aspen Times photographer, and I were hiking back down on Saturday on the same trail, we counted another 40 people going up. Now, not all 42 people that were there Friday night stayed there, but some of them did because some of them were going to be climbing Snowmass Mountain the next day. So let's say you got 40 more people going up. And, you know, there were probably 20 to 30 that were staying up there. So it was even more crowded on Saturday night, I'm sure.
But didn't you mention, too, that there were 450 people on the four-pass loop?
The Rangers the previous week had counted 450 people in the four-pass loop in one day.
I think that's a huge number because that's a difficult hike, and that's really the center of the wilderness around here. That's a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, as we know, the Forest Service is working or looking into a reservation system for the four-pass loop and Conundrum, and I'll certainly cover the issue objectively, but from what I've witnessed so far, I can see how a reservation system is justified.
You know, they did this on a really popular stretch of river on the Colorado that I frequent a lot on Ruby Horse Thief, and it was such a mess to try to deal with when it was not a permitted situation. It was like first come, first serve was the rule, but there was a sign-up sheet, but nobody was following either one of those rules. And, I mean, we were running into conflicts with people, like, taking over our camp.
I've experienced that as well, and and there's nothing worse than that.
It's working very well, and running Westwater, running, you know, it's just like Grand Canyon. At some point, it has to happen. It's much more civilized.
And it preserves what we're selling here. It's not a matter of just saying some people can't go. I look at it as rationing. You know, if we just have a free-for-all out in our backcountry, pretty soon it's not going to be a place anybody wants to go, or it's going to be like Disneyland, which it's very close to that. Like I said, American Lake, Cathedral Lake, Crater Lake, it's not quite the experience it could be.
Right. Scott, were you the one that covered the Gorsuch House?
Yes.
Okay, so there was a doubleheader in the City Hall basement on Tuesday night. City Hall, the future of City Hall here, and the Gorsuch House. And from what I could tell from your article was the Planning and Zoning Commission has some serious concerns about this project with its mass and scale. Just the same stuff that was brought up when there was a proposal to develop on South Aspen Street, you know, a few years back, right? So there's the mass and scale and then the lift issue.
Norway run. That people dismiss a little bit, but I think it's important.
What's your takeaway from that meeting, Scott?
It seemed like the Gorsuch team did a good job of rallying their supporters to the meeting. 2 weeks prior, there had been several speakers and the vast majority of them had spoken in favor of the project. There was there was probably another 10 people that spoke the other day, and most of them were in support of the project. But when it came down to it, and several of the PNC members noted this, it wasn't about whether the development team is good or not. They said they welcomed and they were glad to see that such a strong team had been put together, but that didn't count for what they needed to be looking at. And that was mass and scale and proper zoning, and several of the PNC members pressed the point that the project needs to blend into the neighborhood with kind of the mass and density and the height of the roof at the highest pitches.
My experience with the developers is they downplay those things like moving the lift 80 feet further from town and blocking off access to Norway Slope and having people from the street have to walk another 100 steps to get to the lift. But when you really look at it, those are big deals to people, and to ask them to give those up and not getting much in return except a gigantic building up there.
They'd say, well, we're activating that side of the mountain and we're bringing, you know, restoring historic skiing back to 1A, and it's a World Cup venue, etc.
Sort of, except it looks like it's all about the big building and not so much about skiing when you do things like move lifts uphill and cut off access to ski runs and make skiers walk around your building to get to the lift. So to me, that's smoke. It doesn't ring true to me that they're actually these skiers who care about the history of skiing. I mean, let's put the lift where it should be. Let's keep the runs open. Let's make it easy for skiers to get there, and then put the building in not disturb that.
Let's remember that you're talking about wanting to put a lift down to Dean Street. That is up to the developers below the Gorsuch guys. That's the lift one people.
Yes, it is. But Gorsuch could put the lift to the bottom of their property, which they haven't done.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with writers and editors in the Valley. If you like what you are hearing, please make a donation to the station after the show. Aspen Public Radio is listener-supported, and we rely on you to keep our programming going. Call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
I get a feel that a lot of that, moving the lift uphill into the east, is just to get the lift out of their little courtyard.
Well, it's because there's a huge building to the west. And there's no place else that it can really go with the way their site is plotted out now.
Without intruding on the aesthetics of the building, I think is part of it anyway. But you're right. They curve their building down and around. And you're right. It's the only place it
makes sense to put it now, because you have this kind of hook shaped building.
Yeah.
That's currently where. I mean, if you look at it now, it's really kind of remarkable to walk up there. Now there's the road. There's the summer road that hikers and trucks and whatnot use to go up the mountain. That's where the mass of the building is going to be centered, is on that road.
Yeah.
And so that's what puts it right up at the toe of the Norway Slope. I mean, there's a corner of that building that is literally within a couple feet of where the toe of the slope meets the runout. It's right there.
So it really isn't about the skiing. It's about the building first, and then the skiing has to conform around
it. I did a site visit yesterday with them, and they really downplayed how you would get the run out of Norway.
That makes me so mad. They tell me how I can ski Norway, and I've been skiing it for 40 years of my life. I've skied it thousands of times, and they tell me how I should ski Norway. It makes me mad. It does. It irritates me.
I don't think that was brought up at the Planning and Zoning Commission, but I do remember reading that some of the commissioners want them to redesign that portion of the where there's a hook in the building. Is that right, Scott?
Yeah, I think Jim DeFrancia called it
the knuckle.
The knuckle.
That's what they call it.
And at least one PNZ member, a couple PNZ members brought up the point that if you're sitting down at Old Lift 1 and looking up the mountain, that they would like to see that corridor, that viewplane, left open. And one of the PNZ members said the only way he can see that would be able to happen is if you get rid of that knuckle.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
the curious thing to me is, there's been a lot of discussion about it in the community, but I'm still a little bit baffled as to why we didn't see more of the people that have concerns, why they weren't showing up at the meeting. Maybe people just feel that the P&Z process isn't the step where they want to get involved. I don't know.
As well as I do, Scott, for covering meetings as long as we have, that they show up at the last meeting.
Yeah.
The marathon one where they're making decisions at 12:30 at night in the morning. I think everybody's dreaming to think that you're going to get a lift all the way down to Dean Street. You have to have snow to do that, and snowmaking right up against people's condos is not going to happen. Any sort of mountain ops is really intrusive to just your life.
And I think that's a good analysis, and it's probably true.
Scott, did you hear Jim DeFrancia, who's also a partner in the Gorsuch project, talk about how the T-bar platter pole lift would not work because you have to be an expert skier in which to use it?
I did not hear him say that. He did talk about how in the prior meeting, after that meeting 2 weeks ago, he had said he is uncertain how many people that are skiing today are familiar with those types of lifts. Yeah. I don't think he was saying you got to be an expert to use it. Right.
He made those comments to me. They were in an article in the Daily News talking about why they decided to scrap a platter lift that was, you know, part of a previous iteration that would have run from Dean Street so you could walk to Willoughby Park, you know, get on this lift that tows you up, you know, a couple blocks up the hill, at which point you could then get on the chairlift. And they had determined that they did not want to incorporate that into their site plan. Now, the opponents are saying they didn't want to incorporate it because there's too much building there and there's no room for a landing zone. They're saying, we don't think it's a great method because no one knows how to use it. It's challenging. And he did say, yeah, it's pretty much just a small group of expert skiers that are interested in a platter lift.
That's funny because we all learned how to
The demographic of skiers is old. And anybody who learned to ski back then was on a tow rope or a T-bar.
I think the expert skiers won't waste their time with the platter lift. They'll just walk.
They'll just hoof it up there.
Right. Get loose before they go skiing.
Right.
I thought Tony Wagner had a pretty good idea in his column when he was saying, hey, if we're going to move the lift up, maybe we just need to be walking up to the bottom of Ruthie's.
Right. You also, Scott, had an interesting story about the Basalt Town Council wanting to buy the Pan and Fork parcel. I don't know if this is separate from the $8 million plan from the Citizens Committee that was unveiled last week.
Yeah, so their version of the Parks, Open Space, and Trails Committee was asked some time ago to just take a look at what, if a park is going to be at that place, what would they like to see, what kind of amenities would they like. So they've been working on that plan with some consultants for a while, and they came up with a wish list that had totaled up to $8 million. That's including some infrastructure changes. And some of the Basalt, and so that got presented to the Basalt Town Council, and some of the council members are saying, you know, we really need, before we can even really be talking about how much we're going to be spending on a park, we first need to figure out what are we going to do with the part of that parcel, the old Pan and Fork mobile home park, that we don't own. There's about 2.3 acres that the town doesn't own, and it owns about 3 acres already closest to the river. So, yeah, some members are saying, why don't we see if the nonprofit company that owns that private land, if they'd be willing to sell, then we can more fully figure out what we're going to do with the park. They want to get something on the November ballot, and to do that, you need to have a ballot question form toward the end of August. So they've got a Herculean task ahead of them to try to figure out what they want to do over the next 5 weeks.
There was no price tag on that, right, yet?
No. I mean, at one point, Roaring Fork Community Development Corporation, which is a nonprofit that owns the 2.3 acres closest to Two Rivers Road, at one point, the figure of $3 million had been thrown out as a asking price. Whether that's still valid or whether factors have changed, I don't know yet.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they follow the Aspen lead. I don't think any open space acquisition has ever been shut down here, has it?
Do they have the money to buy it, Scott, if they wanted to?
Yeah, you know, and the important thing to remember is the council hasn't said that they are endorsing this $8 million plan yet. If you add on $3 million, you'd be looking at potentially $11 million, and I would be willing to bet they will figure out a way to pare some of that money down.
Also, government development or non-government development across the hall from the Gorsuch. P&Z hearing was the Aspen City Council's 5-hour deliberation on whether or not they should build a 52,000 square foot city hall. It wasn't surprising to me that Steve Skadron, the mayor, doesn't want to build that, because when I spoke to him when he was getting on a plane to go to Taiwan, wherever he was going, he said, you know, what I'm hearing on the street is there's no appetite for this. So we're putting it on hold.
And part of it was, I think he switched his stance on that, right?
He had voted a couple of times over the last year in favor of the move out of City Hall,
right,
build the 52,000 square foot building plan. And really for the last maybe 4 months, they have been in, you know, reevaluating that decision. And it finally came to a head this week. When, yeah, I mean, Steve did. He basically went up there and said, I am no longer in favor of the direction that we've been going here for the last year.
What does he want, though? I was not clear on what his
He wants
option.
To keep the city hall, the seat of government, in its current building, in that historic armory downtown. He says that's part of our character. That's part of what makes this town what it is. Everyone basically agrees the city could use a little more space, and they could consolidate. You know, they got offices strewn about all over the place, and you know, a lot of them really don't have good facilities for the public. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of debate on the necessity of doing something, but what to do has really just, it's been tearing at the council for a long time. You know, you have two council members who are still very much in favor of the plan to move out of City Hall. You have Bert, who, you know, he's going to chain himself to the to the bulldozer, if you will. And Steve, you know, came out and said, after a lot of soul searching, I can't support this direction anymore. And really, I think a lot of what this comes down to is what happens to City Hall if you were to leave. I mean, and this is one of the reasons why I wasn't so impressed with us having the vote last November as to whether or not you want offices or community use, because you know, you have a group that's coming forward and talking a big talk about how they're going to raise $10 million and they're going to turn the armory into this great community center that we're all going to love and that we need. And that may be true, but it's very conceptual at this point. So
it's 20,000 square feet more stuff in Aspen, in downtown Aspen.
Right. And that's, you know, that's Bert's point, is that's going to create traffic, and it's going to create a housing need that is not going to be addressed, and it's just going to add
more mass and scale to downtown.
To the problem. So
where are they at? What's the direction then?
Well, it's just continuing to evaluate this thing. So now what the staff is going to do is take a real hard look at what it would look like to stay in City Hall and to build a smaller building where they were going to build the big building.
And isn't one of the arguments that it would be far more expensive to modernize the current City Hall than to build a new one?
That is one of the arguments.
Yeah, and you know, I'm saying this because I'm like Mayor Skadron. I've changed my position on this too. I originally thought the armory would be cool if it was a community center, and then you know, my thinking has changed. Like, well, that's 20,000 square feet more in town that we probably don't need.
I would like to note, you know, it is our summer pledge drive, and if you're listening, you're listening to the most popular show on our radio station. So I appreciate you guys participating. And I'll tell you, if I thought about it the other day, the people who are on this show right now, collectively, we have over 100 years of experience, of knowledge in this valley. I mean, Scott, you've been on the beat for how long here?
Since 85.
Right. I've been since 95. Roger, you've been here for eternity.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to define what the beat is.
Right. Just having that sort of perspective of this valley and how it's changed. And Curtis, you've been at the helm and at Daily News for, what, 10 years now?
I'm the baby here.
Yeah, but that's still, I mean, the residents should feel lucky to have veteran journalists who are still here that can give the context and the history when we need to.
We give it freely, don't we?
Yes, we sure do. So, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah. It's a great forum for us.
And thank you to our listeners who support Aspen Public Radio. And if you value what you're listening to, please call 920-9000 or make your pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks again. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Valley Roundup. Thanks to Roger Morrell, columnist for the Aspen Times and Snowmass Sun, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Scott Condon, reporter for the Aspen Times, and Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post Independent. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our station. Call 920-9000 or make your donation at aspenpublicradio.org.